Buddha's enlightenment was his awakening, his understanding, his insight into the ultimate reality, into truth with a capital T.
Hey there, how's it going? I just wanted to take a minute to say hello. Dave Smith here with Dave Smith Dharma Podcast. I have some long-awaited new talks coming up here. I hope you enjoy them. I'm also getting my audio game a little bit together here, so you might notice some of the newer talks sound a little more crisp. And this talk that's coming up here is on the Four Great Efforts, which was given at the Durango Dharma Center. Much love to the good people out in Durango for showing up. What an awesome community out there. And so I hope you enjoy the talk. There'll be others coming up. And also, you'll find a link here in this talk on a new class I have out, an online class, a secular mindfulness practice and education course, which I've put a lot of time in. And you can check out the link and see if that's something you want to do. And if not, we'll see you soon. Take care and enjoy.
As an easeful and natural state of mind.
I've had the good fortune in the last few weeks of doing a lot of driving in this part of the country, and it's my favorite place to drive. Last week, I was down at the Upaya Zen Center. I don't know if anybody's ever been there. Upaya Zen Center in Santa Fe, New Mexico. It's Joan Halifax's spot. Roshi Joan, who is just an amazing person, who I got to spend some time with because she was there. I got to have a meal or two with her and talk to her a little bit. Very dynamic woman to be in the presence of, no doubt. And I was there with Stephen Batchelor, who was doing a retreat. I did a five-day retreat on the topic of autonomy, care, and something else that didn't make sense at the time, but did at the end of the retreat. Some of these retreats are interesting the way they're titled, right? And so I want to talk tonight about wisdom and effort, and also a little bit about this idea, this word of knowing. So wisdom, usually when we think of Buddhism, we think of Dharma practice, the word wisdom usually kind of enters into the equation relatively quickly. And it's a word that's kind of bothered me for three decades, because if pressed, I'm not really sure what it is. I'd be hard-pressed to define it. I know that it's important. I know that it's a big aspect of the Dharma and of the Buddhist teachings, is the breakthrough to wisdom. But I find it to be somewhat daunting. I don't think it's necessarily so important that I or we know what it is, but be able to know when it is, to know when it's present in our mind, when it's here. And I've also found it to be very helpful when I can recognize it in other people. I actually find it's much easier for me to recognize wisdom in other people than in myself. I'm sure you've all had the experience of meeting somebody and you just get a visceral kind of scent from them of like, oh, I like this person. They seem to know what they're talking about. I almost feel like an attraction to that, a sense of wisdom. And then we have this sort of ongoing struggle, I think, in the practice of trying to translate, or I have a struggle trying to translate these ancient ideas that come from this language that nobody uses anymore, from the Pali into English, to really try to comprehend and to understand and to really put into effect or put into my life, you know, the Buddha's message, the Dharma. I'd love to ask him a few questions, but I don't think I'm going to get a chance. And I think part of it is we talk about wisdom, we a lot of times associate it with knowledge. So in Pali, the Pali word is panya, which means wisdom. It also means a kind of knowledge, is the way we would think about it. Also, I think in our modern sense, in our secular thinking, I think we could actually really use the word intelligence. There's an ethical intelligence to wisdom. There is a contemplative intelligence. There's an emotional intelligence. And if really pushed, I think what the Buddha's talking about is wisdom is really trying to come to terms with the very specific, very particular conditions of whatever a moment that you find yourself in. and all of the complex moments that you have found yourself in, and being able to show up and to respond in that moment in a way that does not increase suffering to myself or to others, but really actually skillfully brings a sense of ease and presence and kindness in flourishing to myself and to others. And if I look back in my past, boy, I've gotten that wrong a lot in moments before. I don't always get the wisdom thing down. And our culture is so knowledge-based. We still want to have the answer. What's the answer? I want to know the answer. We're so much accustomed to knowing. But there's a big difference, I think, between knowing that and then knowing how. And I think this is where the Buddha takes things a lot further than we generally do and did a really good job of unpacking these things in a way so that really I think that Dharma practice is really a behavioral system more than a belief system. It's knowing how to do something rather than knowing the right answer or knowing all the lists or all of the precepts and all of the that's of that. Like, are you all aware of the fact that things change and things are impermanent? You know that, right? Do you know how to respond and how to show up in moments when there's real change going on? Do you know how well do you show up in the face of real loss, real confusion, real the rug getting pulled out from underneath you? Do you know how to move through those experiences? You guys know that there's this thing called suffering, part of life, kind of built into the fabric of the world. Do you know how to respond to it wisely, skillfully, effectively, and in the moments of your life when you encounter it? Probably, you know, mixed. So I feel, in recent years, I feel that a lot of the practice is a willingness to be really to risk and a willingness to be wrong rather than this knowing what's right. And this constant, and the reason I've come to this a lot in the last couple of years is I have children now. I know that children exist. I don't know how to raise them. I'm learning. So they're sort of my greatest teachers, and one of my sons is 7, and he's I'm not the bio dad, but I've been in his life for a long time, and that's been complicated. And we have a baby now. It was 1.5, I think was here last time with us. And so I feel like it's this constant willingness to really be willing to just not get it right. And that knowing how to not get it right has been a lot more important to me and a lot more useful to me than knowing that and becoming kind of a know-it-all in a way in which sometimes I've been guilty in the past of sort of trying to, proselytize or trying to kind of impose my Buddhist view on people. Doesn't really pan out so well. Have you noticed people don't like it when you impose your views on them? Do you like it when people impose their views on you? And not so much. Not that skillful, it turns out. And the interesting thing about this word knowing also, to just kind of stay with the word a little bit, because this stuff I think I find it to be interesting and helpful, is that in English we use the word knowing in such a wide range of ways. Like, I know that I'm in the city of Durango. I also know Erin Treat is your guiding teacher. And the way that I know that this is Durango and the way that I know Erin, they're very different kinds of knowing. So the way that we know a fact or a person, place, or thing, and the way that we know our relationships is very, very different kind of knowing. In fact, most languages other than English have terms that distinguish between knowing a factual piece of information. I know that 2 and 2 is 4. I also know my mom. And the way that I know my mom is very different than I know that. So there's a way in which this can kind of knowing is a really, is a trial and error. There's an intimacy component to it. There's a relational component to it. And a lot of the wisdom that we come to really comes from kind of
dropping the ball a lot of the times, not getting it right, not knowing sometimes what to do. And also really trying to break out of the black and white thinking of sort of right and wrong. There is a range of other options between right and wrong, right? There's some ambiguity. Sometimes it's like, well, I mostly did the right thing there. I did okay. Didn't go exactly how I wanted to, or I wish I could have said it better, but that's okay. There's a tremendous play, I think, in this practice for humility, which is a word that doesn't show up so much in Dharma, although the idea is definitely implied in most of it. But it's just this willingness to be wrong and this willingness to really be human and this willingness to not be fully awakened. And this idea that we want to be careful that we don't put this idea of awakening or enlightenment, which is a term I rarely use, on this pedestal that becomes so high that it becomes totally unachievable. There's a, you might be able to find that online, there is an essay written by Ajahn Buddhadasa, who is a Thai forest monk from this century, who was very controversial in the Thai forest tradition, but he wrote an essay called Nibbana is for Everyone. And this idea that awakening and that what the Buddha is teaching and what we're trying to do in our practice is actually for everyone. It's very ordinary. We all have had many, many moments of awakening in our lives. Tremendous amount of wisdom in this room. But sometimes we brush that aside or we don't forget that. We don't bring that with us into our practice. That even before we start practicing, even before we engage in a path like this, there's already a whole bunch of stuff we already know that's actually quite useful. And so the know-how, well, how do we do this? You know, the general prescription is the cultivation of the Eightfold Path. And it brings me to this word I want to talk about, effort, which I've already given you an example of, not great effort. But then we're back to trouble again because there's right effort. And this word right, I think, really, really has plagued the Buddhist tradition, especially in our English thinking. The word right comes from this Pali word sama, which doesn't really mean right at all. It means actually complete or appropriate or skillful. So what's the appropriate effort? What's the complete effort? What's the skillful effort? It actually implies a task of something that needs to be done. And so when we look at the practice and the teachings on right effort, I don't know if it's true, but I've been told many times by several people that the Buddha spoke more about right effort than he did any other topic, because this is a really hard work. You know, this is really the work of it all, the elbow grease of Dharma practice, and really being willing to take it into these very particular and specific complex situations in our life. Where can we bring presence and ease, where we mostly bring aversion and resistance. Now, there's a lot of stuff going on in the world right now that I don't need to get into that I feel a lot of aversion towards, a lot of resistance, even maybe some disgust. I don't even want to go there. And so that's not a great effort. Aversion is not generally taught as a liberation strategy anywhere that I'm familiar with. You know, if I just stick my head in the sand long enough, maybe things will be better. Nope, going back down. 2020, not so great, actually. And so he breaks it down in really very skillful and I think very clear and concise ways where the goal of the practice is to use our contemplative training and our contemplative practice of focused attention and concentration and mindfulness and awareness to basically, there's four words you can break it down. It's to prevent, to overcome, to develop, and to maintain. Right? So what are we trying to prevent and overcome? What are we trying to develop and maintain? Well, we have this, again, this problematic thing of we're trying to prevent and overcome unwholesome mind states, unwholesome attitudes, unwholesome behaviors, and we're trying to develop and maintain wholesome ones. But again, doesn't wholesome and unwholesome really sound like right and wrong? It even sounds a little bit moralistic. I have yet to come up with words that work because we're so, the water that I'm swimming in as a human being is so dictated by right and wrong. I don't know how to get my mind out of it. But really, I think it's about skillful and unskillful. And the language that I really like that comes from the emotional intelligence movement that I think is really, really good is this idea of destructive and constructive. Right? And so that destructive mental states, behaviors, attitudes of mind are mind states and attitudes of mind that lead to suffering for myself, hardship for myself, or that of others. And I want to prevent those from arising, and I want to overcome them when they have arisen. I don't think that's a hard sell. And so they're destructive because they actually block us. It's not they're destructive like they're bad and wrong and I have to get rid of them and now we're back to aversion, which doesn't work so good. It's not that they're bad or wrong, it's that they actually block us from what we really want. They get in the way of our well-being. They get in the way of our happiness. They get in the way of our connection to the world, to the planet. They're hindrances. They impede. Right? And I'm sure you can all give me countless examples of situations that you find yourself in where that's the case. In the emotional intelligence work that I do, we call these, you'll like this one, it's one of my favorite terms, a regrettable emotional episode. Have you had a regrettable emotional episode? We're like, I can't believe I did that. Then the guilt and the shame arise. Which actually turned out to be constructive in that situation, which is ironic. I'm trying to tell us, maybe next time you get angry, you want to pay a little bit more attention. Right? And then, of course, when we become emotional, this game becomes a lot more difficult. Right? Because that comes from the work of Daniel Goleman that was inspired by the Dalai Lama in this book, Destructive Emotions. Is that a lot of our suffering, if we look back historically and make a list, most of my suffering that I experience now is something that I did or said or didn't do or say when I was in an emotional experience. And I could probably give you some examples of things that happened 15, 20 years ago that still bug me. So we really want to take this teaching seriously, I think, because we pay for it. I pay for it. And so when we think about you know, there's the mental state, the general state of mind, the attitude or the disposition we have towards the experience, and then the emotional component that can often be there. So, of course, probably no big surprise here, our best ally in this whole endeavor is mindfulness. Because when we're mindful, when mindfulness is present, when we're aware, we can start to recognize, oh, I need to be careful, I need to be heedful, I'm really caught in this aversion filter. I'm really caught in this resistance. I'm really caught in this blaming experience. And the other thing about this I think that's so important that I want to flag and highlight is we have to be very careful that we don't think that we're bad or wrong for having the mind state. I'm supposed to be a Dharma practitioner. I shouldn't be having these. And then we can kind of become fake and inauthentic and pretend like we don't ever have destructive mental states the 47 times a day that we do. It's not about fault. It's not about not getting it right. It's not about any of that. It's just we live in a mind-body system where as we're this organism that comes in contact with an environment, a lot of times we come into contact with experiences that warrant aversion, anger, fear, confusion, contempt. Right? But the mindfulness comes after that. Right? You know, as much as we think about it as prevention, I always find I catch it after the fact. And then I have this beautiful thing called choice. If I have mindfulness, then I have choice. And again, in the emotional intelligence work that I do, the general equation is awareness plus choice equals freedom. And so we become aware. And that's that overcoming it in the present moment. It's like, oh, I got really, really angry there, really, really aversive. I wanted to do or say a bunch of stuff that would have been not cool, and I didn't. Now, that little 5 or 10 second thing might have been very unpleasant and very difficult to be with. But we have to realize that that was a successful experience. because we were able to overcome. Maybe even we were able to prevent. We got the initial reaction of aversion or resistance, but we were able to prevent that chain, that causal chain of being irritated and aggravated to becoming entitled and rageful and angry and then retaliatory. So sometimes we don't give ourselves credit for a lot of the really skillful episodes that we have because we were having some internal struggle during those. And I think the willingness to have an internal struggle is really, really an important part of the practice. In fact, to some degree, I feel that when we talk about sila, we talk about integrity and ethics and really wanting to take this on, I feel by taking that on, I actually sacrifice, I sacrifice some peace of mind in that endeavor because I'm willing now to confront and to face and to work with the ethical dilemma that I might be in any given moment. You know, the very specific and very particular heat of the moment that you find yourself in, right? That present moment experience. Right now, this is really, really hard. And I'm actually willing to really, to be in this difficult experience because I want to learn something about this. And that's the learn how. We learn how to cultivate wisdom by screwing up to some degree, by getting it wrong, by not seeing things clearly. That's really actually where all the learning is. And even just sitting quietly by yourself. I know that, like, I swear to God, for the first 2 minutes of every meditation that I ever do when I sit down, I deal with the fact of something in my system's like, really? This again? I so don't want to do it for like at least a minute or two. But I'm so familiar with it. I've seen it so many times that I just be with it. And then it subsides, it falls away. And I know it does because I've seen it happen thousands of times. This is not easy work. This is not always pleasant work. And so when we do these first, we want to be able to prevent and to overcome these destructive, unwholesome mental states from arising. And the more that we see them, the more that we face them, the more that we're honest about them, the more that we're familiar with the ones that get us. I'm sure you have your top three favorite ones, or at least top three common ones. They might not be your favorite. It's really trying to develop and to maintain constructive mental states, constructive states of mind, things like mindfulness, curiosity, interest, equanimity. There's a whole range of them. There's a whole big, awesome list, as there always is in Dharma, of these skillful mental states, right? And those, it's not that they're good or right, it's that they lead to flourishing. They allow us to have the life that we want to have. They allow us to be the people that we want to be. They allow us to engage in relationships with ourselves and others in the world in a way that we want to, because we're not being blocked by our fears and our aversions and our beliefs and our opinions and all of that. And so we can kind of recognize these when they're present. And even in the instructions I gave tonight, it's seeming to me more and more that mindfulness, which is of course sort of become a cultural phenomenon on its own, is a very ordinary thing. It's even maybe boring at times. It's nothing, it's not some privileged state that is exclusive to the Buddhist world. There's actually this term called Pacheka Buddha. I don't know if you ever heard of Pacheka Buddha. The Buddha spoke about in the early canon. And a Pacheka Buddha is somebody who's just awakened. They haven't had to do any of this hard work that we have to do. They're just like good people who do the right thing just because. Do you know any Pacheka Buddhas? I know a couple, and they kind of drive me crazy with envy. I think one of my sisters is a Pacheka Buddha because she's just kind and nice and friendly and mostly always does the right thing, just sort of like seems easy. I'm like, I've been grinding this out for 3 decades and I'm still trying to get this stuff down. Right? There are those people there. It's not this experience of mindfulness or the experience of wisdom or the experience of awakening. It's not some a state or experience that's privileged to sort of the Buddhist world, although the Buddha did recognize it as a human possibility and was kind enough to develop a very specific system for how we could obtain it. But we have words like mindfulness, is to be present and to just be aware, which is also very close to what we would call in the Third Noble Truth, Nibbana or Nirvana. It's very much the same thing. It's just the mind of non-reactivity. And as we use this effort, as we go into what's traditionally known as the Four Noble Truths, which the word Noble Truths makes me cringe slightly, but we're stuck with it, capital N, capital T. But again, we're back into this problem of knowing that this is the truth, rather than knowing how to. So we come into contact, as we're human beings moving through our experience, moving through the world, we're just these organisms constantly coming into contact with an environment. Right? And when we come into contact with pain and difficulty and what's often called suffering, do we know how to embrace that? Because that's actually the skill, the task of the first truth. If we unpack the sutta all the way down, the Buddha's not just saying these things are there, he's actually telling us what to do. And how do we comprehend suffering? How do we relate to it? How do we embrace it? Which is really the arising of compassion. Once I truly know that this is part of the human dilemma, I might find that I start treating people differently. Everybody's having their own difficult time in the backstage of their mind. And a lot of times we have no idea what's going on back there. And I find the more that I'm able to take that on as a practice, the less reactive my mind becomes. And then when my mind is not reactive, I have this sort of mindfulness or this nibbana or this intelligence or this wisdom of I'm actually in a given experience, I'm in the present moment experience, and I'm aware of the fact that there's maybe something I could do about this rather than just defaulting to my old opinions or my old beliefs or my old dogmatic list of, I can tell you how to fix that. And this really opens up this development. We can develop this way of moving through the world, and we can maintain this way of moving through the world. And as the old story goes, a tree that leans to the west will fall to the west. And the tree that leans to the east will fall to the east. And the Buddha makes the same analogy about our internal experience, our minds. As we incline, which is really what we do in practice, we incline, we cultivate, we aim our minds in a particular direction. And if we keep aiming in that particular direction, if we keep trying and putting in effort, it's going to fall that way. It will just become more gradual, become more habituated. Habits aren't always bad. Habits are, we could say, ethically neutral. They're just habits. We have some good habits, some not so good habits. And so we can actually develop this in our minds, in our experience, in our behaviors, in our speech, in our action, in everything that we do. And as I'm sure you've seen, as we all do this, I find this thing to just be a whole learning process of learning what's working and what's not working, and what's working and what's not working. Being like, oh, this didn't work last time. Maybe try something different this time. And there's that effort, which comes from this word virya, which is a really hard word to translate. Sometimes it's translated as effort or energy. If I take a little creative liberty, which I will, I actually really feel to some degree the word is about enthusiasm. So there's effort, but backed by a sense of confidence, right? Backed by a sense of like, I think I might be able to do this. You could probably reflect or think about that time when maybe you read a book or you heard a podcast or you came here or you practiced. You remember that first hit you got of like, oh, I think this is going to be good for me. This is maybe what I need. There's an enthusiasm that comes. It doesn't necessarily hang out that long. But anybody who's willing to sit quietly for 30 minutes and be in their direct experience, I would argue has some degree of confidence, enthusiasm, that there's something to be gotten out of that. Because right? It's hard to just sit quietly with your mind and to do nothing, especially in this world. To do nothing for 30 minutes? I have so many things to do. I'm just going to sit here? Really? What about? Right? That kind of, we live in this to do. In a lot of the ways, the wisdom is the knowing is sort of the way that we see things and the way that we understand things. It's not so much in this incessant to do, which is the Buddhist term sankhara, which is actually one of the aggregates. It's one of the formations of mind that I notice when I practice meditation or when I sit quietly by myself. There is this mechanism in my mind that's reminding me that there are other activities that could be happening right now. Just so you know. If you want to sit here, you can do your thing. But, and that's really, really hard to come to terms with, that busyness of mind. I'm trying to, again, bring the effort of getting the attention out of that. And really trying to come to terms and to try to work with this monkey mind or this ruminating mind. And all the evidence in the neuroscientists, Richard Davidson has this great quote that's maybe a little bit hard to hear, but they say that a wandering mind is an unhappy mind. And that 80% of the time when our mind is wandering, we end up sort of just feeling bad. Right? And when we practice Dharma, when we practice mindfulness, we're really actually going against that stream of that incessant mind wandering. We're saying, no, like, park it. You know, that coming back and that training of the mind is so valuable and so important to everything. But it feels like work. It still feels like a bit of work. And the three survey says, the top three topics of mind rumination, self, other, past and future. Right? When your mind is wandering, are you sort of roaming around one of those three territories? Sure. And so in that process, we're not accessing things like these constructive mental states, like interest or curiosity or presence or kindness or imagination or creativity or the sense of doing something differently. We block those. So it's not that wandering mind is bad and wrong and we have to get rid of it, but it does get in the way. It gets in the way of us really being able to aim our life's attention and our mind in the directions that we want it to go. And so that it's not that it's necessarily destructive in that way, but we can find that a lot of these things, I like to flip the script on this because I feel like in all the years I've been practicing and teaching, to some degree I feel like Buddhism, and we've declared a little bit of a war against suffering, and that if we did this right, we wouldn't suffer anymore. And I think that's a bad setup. It's not, so I like to think of dukkha or this difficulty that we talk about. It's just blocking us. It's just a blockage from having a life, a flourishing life. Having the life that we want to have. The Greeks call it eudaimonia, or anorexia, the untroubled mind, the life that flourishes. And I know that when I am not flourishing, when I feel stuck, there's usually some fear, there's some opinions, there's some old ideas, there's something holding me back. This figure in Dharma practice called Mara, sometimes the Buddha talks about, is the one who blocks. He creates limitations. It's the way your mind. You're not going to be able to do that. Who do you think you are? You're not going to go back to school and get a degree. You're not going to blah 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 blah. That sort of internal critic blocks us from doing the things that we want to do. So in the parlance of this right effort, it's a great. I found this practice to be very useful because when I sit, it gives me a sense of enthusiasm, it gives me a sense of okay, this is the task at hand. Okay, trying to recognize these aspects of my own mind that are getting in the way, overcoming those, preventing and overcoming those. And the only way I'm going to do that is to become familiar with them, to know them intimately, rather than to have the list. Well, having the whole list of destructive or afflictive mental states doesn't always translate in real time, does it? Like, hold on, let me go get my list that's in the car. But being able to just be like, okay, this isn't helpful right now. This isn't helpful right now. That's the way I feel it in my body and my mind. I'm like, this is not helpful right now. This isn't going to translate into this moment's experience in a way that's going to be helpful to me or the person in front of me. I could kind of put that side, cool down, and then the interest and the curiosity, and they're like, well, gee, what? I wonder what I could do right now that might, maybe nothing. I think the hardest thing about compassion I've noticed when I'm working with another person who's having a hard time or having a really hard time or is going through some big loss or is to just shut up and just not even say anything. That's like the most compassionate thing you can do sometimes, right? Rather than to fix or to reassure or to re-explain, just be like, and to just be with somebody in that experience. It's really hard. So sometimes that's the best thing to do, is to do nothing, or to just be in that space with somebody. And if I can't be in that space with myself, there's probably unlikely that I'm going to be able to be in that space with you. Right? And then this practice becomes more relational, which I think for the current world in which we live in, and again, so such good fortune for you to have each other in all of this, because Thich Nhat Hanh has this theory that I like about the third coming of the Buddha is actually going to be not Buddha Dharma, but Sangha. The last Buddha gave us the Dharma, he gave us this map, and that this next awakening is actually going to be a culture of awakening, and that we're involved in. Actually, if you look at the current landscape, there's a lot of people doing these practices now. It's a culture of awakening. It's not about one person doing it and teaching it. That guy was 2,500 years ago. We already did that. Right? Can we do this together? Can we wake up? Can we wake up together? And can we relate to each other in a way that's true and authentic, that really is constructive for the people around us? Even if they don't share our Buddhist view or they don't share our beliefs about certain things. Which is hard work, I find. But it's playing to people's humanity and the shared universal experience of suffering rather than comparing what we know versus what they know and creating divisiveness and division and conflict. This strategy has not done us very well, has it? So I'm going to stop there. I want to see if you have any questions, and I have a few announcements to make. So thank you for your kind attention this evening.